Geostatistics Explained, Chapter 20, Introductory Concepts of Multivariate Analysis. 20.1, Introduction. So far, all of the analyses discussed in this book have been either for univariate or bivariate data. Often, however, Earth scientists need to analyze samples of multivariate data, where more than two variables are measured on each sampling or experimental unit, because univariate or bivariate data do not give enough detail to realistically describe the material or environment being investigated. For example, a large ore body may contain several different metals, and the concentrations of each of these may vary considerably within it. It would be useful to have a good estimate of this variation, because some parts of the deposit may be particularly worth mining, others may not be worth mining at all, or certain parts may have to be mined and processed in different ways. Data for only one or two metals, e.g. copper and silver, are unlikely to be sufficient to estimate the full variation in composition and value within a deposit that also includes lead and zinc. Examples on which multivariate data have been measured are often difficult to compare with one another because there are so many variables. In contrast, samples where only univariate data are accessible easily can be visualized and compared. Where only univariate data are available can easily be visualized and compared, e.g. by summary statistics such as the mean and standard error. Bivariate data can be displayed in a two-dimensional graph with one axis for each variable. Even data for three variables can be displayed with a three-dimensional graph. But as soon as you have four or more variables, the visualization of these in a multidimensional space and comparison becomes increasingly difficult. For example, Table 20.1 gives data for the concentrations of five metals at four sites. Although this is only a small data set, it is difficult to assess which sites are most similar or dissimilar. Incidentally, you may be thinking this is a very poor sampling design because the data are only given for one sampling unit at each site. This is true, but here we are presenting a simplified data set for clarity. Table 20.1, the concentrations of five metals at four sites, A through D. From these raw data, it is difficult to evaluate which sites are most similar or dissimilar. Earth scientists need ways of simplifying and summarizing multivariate data to compare samples. Because univariate data are so easy to visualize, the comparison among the four sites in Table 20.1 would be greatly simplified if the data for the five metals could be somehow reduced to a single statistic or measure. Multivariate methods do this by reducing the complexity of the datasets while retaining as much information as possible about each sample. The following explanations are simplified and conceptual, but they do describe how these methods work. 20.2, simplifying and summarizing multivariate data. The methods for simplifying and comparing samples of multivariate data can be divided into two groups. The first group of analyses works on the variables themselves. They reduce the number of variables by identifying the ones that have the most influence on the observed differences among sampling units, so that relationships among units can be summarized and visualized more easily. These, quote, variable-oriented, unquote, models are often called R-mode models. The second group of analyses works on the sampling units. They often summarize the multivariate data by calculating a single measure or statistic that helps to quantify differences among sampling units. These, quote, sampling-oriented, unquote, methods are often called Q-mode analyses. This chapter will describe an example of an R-mode analysis followed by two Q-mode ones. 20.3, an R-mode analysis, principal components analysis. Principal components analysis, PCA, which is called principal components analysis, principal component singular analysis in some texts, is one of the oldest multivariate techniques. The mathematical procedure of PCA is complex and uses matrix algebra, but the concept of how PCA works is very easy to understand. The following explanation only assumes an understanding of the correlation between two variables. Chapter 15. If you have a set of data where you have measured several variables on a set of sampling objects, e.g. a number of sites or cores, for which PCA are often called objects, it is very difficult to compare them when you have data for more than three variables, e.g. the data in Table 20.1. Quite often, however, a set of multivariate data shows a lot of redundancy, that is, two or more variables are highly correlated with each other. For example, if you look at the data in Table 20.1, it is apparent that the concentrations of copper, zinc, and silver are positively correlated. that when there are relatively high concentrations of copper, there are also relatively high concentrations of silver and zinc, and vice versa. Furthermore, the concentrations of copper, silver, and zinc are also correlated with gold, but we have deliberately made these correlations negative. When there are relatively high concentrations of gold, there are relatively low concentrations of copper, silver, and zinc, and vice versa, because negative correlations are just as important as positive ones. These correlations are an example of redundancy within the dataset, because four of the five variables are well correlated, and knowing which correlations are negative and which are positive, you really only need the data for one of these variables to describe differences among sites. Therefore, you could reduce the data for these four metals down to only copper, silver, gold, or zinc, plus lead in Table 20.2 with little loss of information about the sites. A principal components analysis uses such cases of redundancy to reduce the number of variables in a dataset, although it does not exclude variables. Instead, PCA identifies variables that are highly correlated with each other and combines these to construct a reduced set of new variables that still describes the differences among samples. These new variables are called principal components and are listed in decreasing order of importance, beginning with the one that explains most of the variation among sampling units, followed by the next greatest, etc. With a reduced number of variables, any differences among sampling units are likely to be easier to visualize. Table 20.2. Because the concentrations of copper, silver, gold, and zinc are correlated, you only need data for one of these, e.g., silver, plus the concentration of lead, which is not correlated, to describe the differences among sites. 20.4. How does a PCA combine two or more variables into one? This is a straightforward example where the data for two variables are combined into a new variable, and we are using a simplified version of the conceptual explanation presented by Davis, 2002. Imagine you need to assess variation within a large ore body for which you have data for the concentration of silver and gold at 10 sites. It would be helpful to know which sites were most similar and dissimilar, and how the concentrations of silver and gold varied among them. The data for the 10 sites has been plotted in Figure 20.1, which shows a negative correlation between concentrations of silver and gold. This is a strong relationship between two variables and can be used to construct a single combined variable to help the comparisons among the 10 sites. Note that you are not interested in whether the variables are positively or negatively correlated. You only want to compare sites. The bivariate distribution of points for these two highly correlated variables could be enclosed by a boundary. This is analogous to the way a set of univariate data has a 95% confidence interval, Chapter 8. For this bivariate data set, the boundary will be two-dimensional, and because the variables are correlated, it will be elliptical, as shown in Figure 20.2. An ellipse is symmetrical, and its relative length and width can be described by the length of the longest line that can be drawn through it, and the length of the shortest line that can be drawn through it, the major and minor axes. Figure 20.3. The relative lengths of the two axes describing the ellipse will depend on the strength of the correlation between the two variables. Highly correlated data, like those in Figure 20.3, will be enclosed by a long, narrow ellipse, but for weakly correlated data, the ellipse will be far more circular. At present, the 10 sites are described by two variables, the concentrations of silver and gold. But because these two variables are highly correlated, all the sites are quite close to the major axis of the ellipse, so most of the variation among them can be described by just that axis. Therefore, if you can think of the major axis as a new single variable that is a good indication of what most of the variation describes among sites. So instead of using two variables to describe 10 sites, the information can be combined into just one. The two axes are called eigenvectors, and the relative length that falls within each ellipse is its eigenvalue. Once the longest eigenvector of the ellipse has been drawn, it is rotated. In the case of Figure 20.3, this will simply be anti-clockwise by about 45 degrees, so that it becomes the new x-axis, Figure 20.4. This new artificially constructed principal component explains most of the variation within the 10 sites. It has no name except principal component number 1, PC1. It is important to remember that PC1 is a new variable. In this case, it's a combination of the two variables, concentration of silver and concentration of gold. The plot of the points in relation to the PCI in figure 20.4 only shows the sites in terms of this new variable. There is nothing about silver or gold in the graph. The new x-axis, PC1, is rescaled to assign the midpoint of the axis the value of 0. This makes the axis symmetrical about 0, so the objects will have both positive and negative coordinates for PC1, figure 20.5. In this example, the points are all close to the major axis, so principal component 1 explains the majority of variation among the sites and can be used to easily assess similarities among them. From figures 20.4 and 20.5, it is clear that sites A, I, and F are more similar to each other than A is to E because the distance between the former three is much shorter. Because there are two variables in the initial data set, principal components analysis also constructs a second component that is completely independent and uncorrelated with principal component 1. The second axis is called principal component 2 and is simply the minor axis of the ellipse shown in figure 20.3, which after rotation described above will be a line perpendicular to PC1. Here, too, the eigenvalue for PC2 corresponds to its relative length and its midpoint is the given value of 0. It is clear that PC2 does not explain very much of the variation among sites. The objects are quite widely dispersed around it, so it is a relatively short eigenvector, figure 20.6. Therefore, most of the variation is described by PC1, and the analysis has effectively reduced the number of variables from 2 to 1. 20.5. What happens if the variables are not highly correlated? As described above, if the variables are highly correlated, the ellipse enclosing the data will be very long and narrow. Therefore, the first eigenvector will be relatively long, with a large eigenvalue, and the second will be relatively short, with a small eigenvalue. In this case, by itself, the new combined variable of the first eigenvector is a good indicator of differences among the sites. In contrast, if the two variables are not correlated, the ellipse will be more circular, and the first and second eigenvectors will both have similar eigenvalues. Therefore, neither can be used by themselves as a good indication of the differences among sites. 20.6. PCA for more than two variables. Principal components analysis becomes particularly useful when you have data for three or more variables. If you have n variables, a PCA will calculate n eigenvectors with n eigenvalues that give the dimensions of the nth dimensional object in an n-dimensional space. This may sound daunting, but it's easy to visualize for only three variables, where the three eigenvectors will be given the dimensions for a three-dimensional object in three-dimensional space. The object will be closer to the spherical for a data set with no correlations, and therefore little redundancy, but very elongated and three-dimensional hyper-ellipsoidal for a set of two or three highly correlated variables. The same applies to however many additional dimensions there are. For three or more variables, the PCA procedure is an extension of the explanation given for two variables in section 20.4. The longest axis of the object is found and rotated so that it becomes the x-axis, lying horizontally to the viewer on a two-dimensional plane with its flat surface facing the viewer, like the page you're reading at this moment. If there are many variables and therefore many dimensions, the rotation is likely to be complex. For example, an eigenvector in three dimensions may have rotated in both the transverse and the horizontal. The eigenvector for the longest axis then becomes principal component 1. After this, the other eigenvectors are drawn. For example, if you've measured three variables, then the three-dimensional boundary enclosing the data points will have three eigenvectors describing its length, breadth, and depth, all at 90 degrees to one another. In many cases, several variables may be highly correlated with each other, so the hyperellipsoid may be relatively simple and may even describe most of the variation among sites in just one or two dimensions. Here's an example. An environmental geochemist sampled sediments along a 100-mile section of coastline, including five estuaries, A through E, that received stormwater runoff from urban areas, and five control estuaries, F through J, that did not. At each site, they obtained data for the concentration of copper, lead, chromium, nickel, cadmium, aluminum, mercury, zinc, total polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and total polychlorinated biphenyls. Wow. These 10 variables were subject to principal component analysis and re-expressed as 10 principal components, giving the shape of a 10-dimensional hyperellipsoid. Because several of the initial variables were highly correlated, the first principal component, PC1, explained 70% of the variation among estuaries. The second, PC2, explained 15% more, and the third, PC3, only 5% of the variation. Therefore, in this case, 85% of the variation among site could be described by a two-dimensional ellipse with axes of PC1 and PC2, and 90% could be described by a three-dimensional ellipse with axes PC1, PC2, and PC3. So the three-dimensional hyperellipsoid will approximate a very elongate, but not very wide, and even less thick object suspended in three-dimensional space. And the remaining seven dimensions will make little contribution to its shape. Therefore, you could take only PC1 and PC2 and plot a two-dimensional ellipse from which you can easily visualize the relationships among the sites. The two principal components explain 85% of the variation, so the closeness of the objects in two dimensions will give you a realistic indication of their similarities. Figure 20.9. The analysis shows two relatively distinct clusters corresponding to the five urban and five control estuaries, consistent with the urban stormwater runoff having a relatively consistent effect, although you need to bear in mind that this is only a mensurative experiment. Figure 20.8. Because several variables are highly correlated, they can be expressed as a hyperellipsoid with one very long axis, PC1, a shorter one, PC2, and a very short one, PC3. Most of the variation can be explained by PC1 and 2. The third component, PC3, accounts for very little variation and could be ignored. Mm. 20.7. The contribution of each variable to the principal components. Although the analysis described above has reduced the 10 variables to two principal components, it is often useful to know which specific variables contribute to each of these components. For example, most of the variation, i.e. PC1, might only be related to that one thing or that other thing, which I don't remember what they stand for. It was that one really complicated hydrocarbon thing and then the other thing. Such an outcome might suggest ways of reducing the effects of urban development upon estuaries. To address questions such as these, PCA also gives the relative contribution of each variable to each component. The output from a PCA usually includes the plot, such as figure 20.9, and a table of eigenvalues. As described above, an eigenvalue gives the relative length of each eigenvector for the dimensions of the hyperellipsoid. As an example, a list of eigenvalues is given in table 20.3, which also gives the percentage of variation explained by each principal component. Here, too, the hyperellipsoid is non-spherical, so you know the variables show redundancy, and the PCA procedure has usefully reduced the number of variables. Importantly, as well as reducing the number of variables to help visualize the relationships among objects, PCA also gives the relative contribution of the original variables to each eigenvalue. The output table from a PCA will contain a list of the original variables and their correlations with each of the principal components. Table 20.4 gives an example of the 10 variables in the estuarine study described above. It is clear that component 1 is mainly composed of variables 3 and 6, which are chromium and aluminum, the two highest positive and negative correlations. In contrast, principal component 2 is largely composed of variables 1, 2, and 10, which are copper, lead, and some thingies. Which two variables make the major contribution to principal component 3? You need to look for the highest correlations, irrespective of their signs. They're, in this case, nickel and cadmium. Figure 20.9. A plot of only PC1 and PC2 can still explain most of the variation among sites A through J. Note that the five urban estuaries are clustered to the right of the plot, and the five control estuaries are clustered to the left. Table 20.3. Typical output table for only the first three components of a PCA. PC1 explains most, 70%, of the variation in the data set, and thus has the largest eigenvalue. Table 20.4. Typical output table from a PCA. The far left-hand column lists the original variables, in this case variables 1 through 10, and the elements they represent. The next three columns represent the first three principal components, and the values in these columns are the correlations between the new components and the original variables. Note that PC1 is primarily composed of the concentrations of variables 3 and 6, while PC2 is primarily composed of the concentrations of variables 1, 2, and 10, also bold. The variables that contribute most to PC3 are 4 and 5. The signs of the correlations are also useful. For example, for principal component 1, table 20.4, the correlation coefficient for variable 3, chromium, is positive, and the one for variable 6, aluminum, is negative. This means that as PC1 increases, chromium concentration also increases, but aluminum decreases. In summary, a PCA has the potential to express multivariate data in a form so that we can more easily understand it, by reducing the number of dimensions so the data can be plotted on a 2- or 3-dimensional graph. It also gives a good indication of which variables contribute most to the differences among sampling units. Figure 20.10. A plot of PC1 and PC2 for 6 sites increasingly distant, site A closest and site F most distant, from a petrochemical plant. The analysis shows a clear graduation through sites A to F. 20.8. An example of the practical use of principal components analysis. A marine geochemist was interested in comparing the hydrocarbons in sediments at 6 sampling sites, each 1 mile apart, running south along the shore and increasingly distant from a petrochemical plant to A, see if there were differences in hydrocarbon levels among the sites, and B, if so, to find out which compounds might be the best indicators of pollution. The geochemist sampled 10 hydrocarbons at each of 6 sites, A through F. A principal components analysis showed that only 2 hydrocarbons, 1 and 6, combined as PC1, contributed to most of the variation among sites and were negatively correlated with PC1, followed by 5 and 9, combined as PC2. When plotted on a graph of PC1 and PC2, there was a clear pattern, figure 20.10, in that the rank order of the sites, running from left to right, corresponded to their distance from the petrochemical plant. Thus, they concluded that the concentrations of only 2 hydrocarbons can explain most of the variation among sites. 20.9. How many principal components should you plot? There are several ways of deciding upon how many components to use in a plot. If you're lucky, you might be in the situation where only 1 or 2 are needed, but this will occur only if they account for almost all of the percentage variation among sampling units. Generally, however, you should not use components with eigenvalues of 1 or less, because this is the level of variation that you would expect by chance, and when there are no strong correlations among variables, and therefore all original variables contribute equally to a component. 20.10. How much variation must a PCA be able to explain before it is useful? Very generally, if the first 2 or 3 components describe more than 70% of the variation among sampling units, then the analysis will produce a plot in 2 or 3 dimensions that is reasonably realistic. Sometimes, however, it may be useful to know that none of the variables within a multivariate data set can explain very much of the variation among sampling units. For example, PCA of a multivariate data set for indicators of air pollution, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, ozone, ammonia, and the concentration of fine particles per cubic meter of air, at sites throughout a city, including the center and the fringes of the outer suburbs, showed no component with an eigenvector value, or an eigenvalue greater than 0.9. None explained more than 16% of the variation among sites. The 2-dimensional plot of the data was almost circular, and the 3-dimensional plot was spheroidal. It was concluded that there was no obvious difference in air quality, in relation to these 5 indicators, at least, across the city. 20.11. Summary and some cautions and restrictions on use of PCA. PCA is a way of reducing the complexity of a multivariate dataset, but it can only do this if some variables are highly correlated. Any highly correlated variables are combined to form principal components, which may allow sampling units on which multivariate data have been measured to be plotted in 2 or 3 dimensions. The contribution of each original variable to the principal components is also given. PCA is best suited to data where there are few zero values, e.g. grain size or concentration. It is not well suited for data such as counts, where many cells in the tables of sites versus variables have a count of 0, e.g. the number of diamonds in each of several 1 cubic meter sampling units of kimberlite. This restriction can be thought of in terms of the PCA constructing new axes from highly correlated variables. If the data contain a lot of zero values for each variable with only some larger numbers, the PCA is likely to overestimate redundancy, just as a group of points close to zero and a few points within a bivariate plot are likely to overestimate the strength of a correlation. The plot provided by a PCA is also sensitive to the scale on which each variable is measured. For example, data on the concentrations of 10 metals might include rare ones measured in nanograms of per gram of sediment and more abundant ones in grams per kilograms of sediment. This will affect the shape of the hyperellipsoid, and if the data are rescaled, e.g. all expressed as nanograms per gram, the PCA plot will stretch or shrink to reflect this. One solution, which is often automatically applied by many PCA programs, is to normalize the data. This is done by converting each datum to a standard z-score, as described in Chapter 8. For each variable, every datum is subtracted from the mean and the difference divided by the standard deviation. This always gives a distribution with a mean of 0 and a standard deviation of 1.0, which provides a way of standardizing the data in just the same way that a data set was standardized for a correlation analysis in Chapter 15. Equation 15.2. 20.12. Q-mode analyses, multidimensional scaling. Q-mode analyses are similar to R-mode ones in that they also reduce the effective number of variables in a dataset, but they do it in a different way. The previous sections describe how PCA combines highly correlated variables in order to create fewer new ones. In contrast, multidimensional scaling, MDS, examines the similarities among sampling units. For example, you might have data for 10 variables, e.g. the concentrations of 10 different hydrocarbons, measured at each of 3 polluted and 3 unpolluted sites. As discussed in relation to principal components analysis, if you were to graph all 10 variables, you would need a 10-dimensional graph that would be impossibly difficult to interpret. Multidimensional scaling is another way of condensing multivariate information so that samples can be usually displayed on a graph with fewer dimensions than the number of variables in the original data set. This method takes the data for the original set of samples and calculates a single measure of dissimilarity between each of the possible pairs of these. These dissimilarity data, which are univariate, are then used to draw a plot of the samples in 2- or 3-dimensional space. Here's a very straightforward example. Imagine you're interested in the spatial relationships among pegmatites from a specific magmatic system. If you were to take 4 different pegmatites, for now we'll call them A, B, C, and D, within a few adjacent counties or quadrangles and measure the distances between every possible pair of these, A to B, A to C, A to D, B to C, B to D, and C to D, then you would construct a matrix shown in Table 20.5. These data indicate the dissimilarity between pegmatites in terms of their distance apart. Pegmatites that are very close together have a low score, while those further apart have a higher score. Knowing the dissimilarity values from the matrix, you could draw at least one map showing the position of pegmatites in 2 dimensions. Not all of the maps would match the actual position of the pegmatites on a real geologic map, but it would be a convenient way of visualizing the relationships among the pegmatites. 2 examples are shown in Figure 20.11. This is what multidimensional scaling does. The example using pegmatites is very simple, but if you have a matrix of dissimilarities among sampling units, then you can use these univariate data to position the units in only 2 dimensions and easily visualize how closely they are related. Those close to each other will be more similar than those further apart. Table 20.5. The dissimilarities expressed in distance apart in kilometers for 4 pegmatites. Those close together will have a low dissimilarity score, while those close further apart will have a higher score. Note that each pegmatite is no distance from itself. The values are duplicated, i.e. the distance between Newry and Phillips is the same as between Phillips and Newry, and the matrix is symmetrical. You only need the similarities either above or below the diagonal showing values of x. 20.13. How is a univariate measure of dissimilarity among sampling units extracted from multivariate data? Univariate measures, such as the Euclidean distance, can be used to indicate dissimilarity between sampling units for which multivariate data are available. The Euclidean distance is just the distance between any two sampling units in 2, 3, 4, or higher dimensional space. Here's an example for only two dimensions. The length of the hypotenuse of a triangle is the square root of the sum of the squared lengths of the other two sides of the triangle, figure 20.12. For example, for two points, A and B, in two-dimensional space, with axes of y1 and y2, and coordinates for point A of y1 equals 6, y2 equals 11, and for point B of y1 equals 9 and y2 equals 13, the distance between them will be the hypotenuse of a triangle which has sides 3 units long, 9 minus 6, on axis y, but 2 units, 13 minus 11, on axis y2. Therefore, the length of the hypotenuse is the square root of 9 plus 4, which is 3.61 units. So the general formula for Euclidean distance between any two points whose coordinates are known in p dimensions is that one, which is 20.1, where y1, y2, y3, and etc. are the number of dimensions. For example, for only two dimensions, y1 and y2 are the x and y axes of a typical two-dimensional scatter plot. The Y terminology is used because the number of dimensions and therefore the number of axes can be two or more. Equation 20.1 gives a single value for the dissimilarity between the two points, just like the distances between pegmatites previously described. If the values for each variable measured on each point are identical, the Euclidean distance and dissimilarity will be zero. Table 20.6 gives an example for three variables. Figure 20.11. The true geologic map, A, and B and C, the two equally plausible multidimensional scaling plots showing the relationships between four pegmatites in terms of their distances apart. Both maps correctly show all of the dissimilarities among the four pegmatites and are therefore equally applicable, even though only one, in this case B, corresponds to the actual position of those pegmatites on the map. Table 20.6. Calculation of the Euclidean distance between samples A and B on which three variables have been measured. The samples can be positioned in a three-dimensional space in relation to their values for each variable. The Euclidean distance is the square root of the sum of the squared differences between samples for each of the three variables, in this case, three trace elements. Figure 20.12. The Euclidean distance between two points, A and B, plotted in two dimensions. 20.14, an example. The data in table 20.7 are for six different trace elements measured on acid sulfate waters extracted from four geothermal wells, A through D. By inspection of these raw data, it's hard to see which of the wells are most similar and which are most dissimilar. In table 20.8, the Euclidean distance has been calculated for each pairwise comparison of sites using equation 20.1 and expressed in a matrix. The calculated matrix of dissimilarities can be used to position the sites on only two-dimensional space as has been done in figure 20.13. The process becomes difficult to do by hand as soon as you have more than three objects, but statistical packages are available to do this. Some of these simply start by placing the sampling units entirely at random in two dimensions. At this stage, the distances among them are extremely unlikely to correspond to actual Euclidean distances. Next, all of the sampling units are moved slightly at random. If this improves the correspondence between the positions of the sites within the two-dimensional space and their known Euclidean distances apart, then change is retained. If it does not improve the fit, then the change is discarded and another change chosen at random. This is done iteratively, which means it is repeated many thousands or tens of thousands of times, and will result in a gradually improving map of the relationship among the sites. Eventually, the fit cannot be improved further, and the process stops. At this stage, there will be a final map showing the best relationship among the sites. Importantly, there may be several possible final maps, so most MDS programs repeat the process several times to establish the most common solution. Figure 20.13. Example of the arrangement of the four sites for which data are given in table 20.7 in two dimensions on the basis of the Euclidean distance between each pair of sites. 20.15. Stress. Ideally, the display of dissimilarities will be two-dimensional because this is the easiest to interpret. Sometimes, however, the sites will not fit well into a flat two-dimensional plane, which will have to be rippled in certain places to place a site or sites so that the appropriate so that they are the appropriate Euclidean distances from all the others. This lack of conformity in a two-dimensional display is called stress and will give a misleading picture of the relationships among sites. For example, a site forced up on a ripple will seem closer to two neighboring sites than it really is when the relationships are viewed as a two-dimensional display. Figure 20.14. Stress can be reduced by increasing the number of dimensions, and there will be no stress at all when the number of dimensions is equal to the number of original variables. But that is unlikely to be useful to you because a multi-dimensional display is usually impossibly complex to interpret. Hopefully, you will get a display with little stress, into only two or three dimensions. Statistical packages that do MDS usually give a value for stress. As a general guide, it should be less than 0.2 and ideally less than 0.1. Figure 20.14. Sometimes sites will not fit into a two-dimensional plane. A. Sites B, C, D, and F are all on the flat floor of the figure. Site A can only be accommodated accurately in relation to the others by placing it in a space above or below C. Seen from above as a two-dimensional map, A is misleadingly close to C. 20.16. Summary and cautions on the use of multidimensional scaling. Multidimensional scaling is a way of displaying sampling units for which multivariate data are available in a reduced number of dimensions. The distance between the sampling units is an indication of their dissimilarity. Unlike PCA, it does not identify which variables contribute to the positions of the sampling units. Many different dissimilarity indices have been developed. For continuous data where there are few values of zero, Euclidean distance is appropriate. MDS is frequently used by biologists and environmental scientists to analyze data for numbers of several different species. Often, these data sets include large numbers of zero values, so dissimilarity indices, e.g. the Bray-Curtis coefficient, which are not biased by the inclusion of zeros, have been developed for those and should be used for any data set that contains a large proportion of zeros. Although MDS is a simple technique for analyzing sampling units in as few as two dimensions, the amount of stress, section 20.15, required to do this needs to be considered, because the two-dimensional projection is likely to be misleading when stress is high. Table 20.9, copied from table 20.8. The matrix of results for the Euclidean distances between all six possible paired combinations of sites shown in table 20.7. 20.17, Q-mode analyses, cluster analysis. Cluster analysis is a method for classifying sampling units into groups called clusters, where those within a particular cluster are more similar to each other than they are to sampling units in other clusters. This is much simpler than it sounds. For example, the A posteriori Tukey test, Chapter 11, for assigning several means to groups based on the criterion of no significant difference among means within each group is a simple univariate clustering method. The following explanation for cluster analysis relies on an understanding of how univariate data for the dissimilarity between sampling units are derived from multivariate data, which was explained in sections 20.13 and 20.14. Just like MDS, cluster analysis uses a matrix of univariate dissimilarities between pairs of sampling units. For example, the data for the concentrations of six metals at four sites in table 20.7 were used to construct the matrix in table 20.8, which had been copied to table 20.9. It gives the Euclidean distance between all possible pairs of four sites. There are several types of cluster analysis, but the most commonly used is a hierarchical clustering, which can be used to construct a dendrogram, a tree-like diagram showing clusters based on the amount of similarity within a cluster. Here's an example. First, to start with, the four sites in table 20.9 can be considered as being in four separate groups or clusters, because none of the dissimilarities between any of them are zero. Figure 20.15, fusion of the two most similar sites, A and D, to give three clusters on the basis of a maximum of 13.3 units of dissimilarity within clusters. Second, the dissimilarities in table 20.9 are examined to find two sites that are most similar. Those are sites A and D, with a dissimilarity between them of only 13.3 units. These two sites are assigned to form the first cluster, with an internal dissimilarity of only 13.3 units, figure 20.15. At this stage, the sites have been assigned to three clusters, one with A and D, plus B and C. The cluster of sites A and D, symbolized as A and D, is then considered as a single sampling unit and the matrix of dissimilarities recalculated. This will not affect the dissimilarity between sites B and C, but the dissimilarity between the site B and the, quote, new sampling unit of cluster A and D, as well as that between site C and cluster A and D, will change. There are several methods for calculating dissimilarity after sites have started to be assigned to clusters. The group average linkage method simply takes the average of the dissimilarity measures between an outside sampling unit, e.g. site B, and those within the cluster, e.g. A and D. Therefore, using the initial dissimilarities given in Table 20.7, the new dissimilarity between site B and the cluster A and D is the average of the dissimilarity between A and B and B and D. This is 52.6 plus 62.2 divided by 2 equals 57.4. In the same way, the new dissimilarity between site C and cluster A and D is the average of the dissimilarity between C and A and between C and D. This is 59.9 plus 63.1 divided by 2 equals 61.5. Note that the dissimilarity between B and C remains the same at 80.9. These dissimilarities will give the reduced matrix in Table 20.10. By inspection of the two most similar sampling units that are now cluster, A and D, and site B, because the dissimilarity is lowest at 57.4. Therefore, these two are now assigned to the same cluster with an internal dissimilarity of 57.4. This gives two clusters, A and B and D, and C, figure 20.16. Figure 20.16, fusion of the first cluster, A and D, and the second most similar, site B, to give two clusters, A and B and D, and site C, on the basis of a maximum of 57.4 units of dissimilarity between clusters. Sorry, within clusters. Next, the matrix of dissimilarities is reduced to the one in Table 20.11. Here, because there are only two sampling units left to compare, the only dissimilarity necessary to calculate is between A and B and D and site C. Here, too, the dissimilarities of the very first matrix, Table 20.9, are averaged. The calculation is slightly more complex because you need to take the average of three dissimilarities, A to C, B to C, and D to C. This is 59.9 plus 80.9 plus 63.1 divided by 3, which is 68.0. These values for increasing dissimilarity can be used to construct the final dendrogram showing the sites grouped into fewer and few clusters. Figure 20.17. The dendrogram shows a three-cluster solution at 13.3 internal dissimilarity, a two-category solution at 57.4 internal dissimilarity, and a single-category solution at 68.0 internal dissimilarity. This result is consistent with the results of the MDS analysis of the same data in Figure 20.13, which is not surprising. The advantage of a cluster analysis is that it gives you a quantitative way of assigning sampling units to groups. For example, from the dendrogram in Figure 20.17, you could suggest that A and D are, quote, in the same group, unquote, which is different from Group B and Group C. Importantly, however, the groupings produced by a cluster analysis are unlikely to correspond to, quote, true categorical attributes, such as black or white sand grains, given as examples of nominal scale data in Chapter 6. Instead, the categories are based on decisions made about dissimilarity, or its converse, similarity, which is a continuous and ratio scale variable. This is an important point. Cluster analysis was primarily developed for taxonomists, biologists who describe and define animal and plant species, as a way of helping them make a decision as to whether individuals should be categorized as the same or different species. Here too, however, even though the analysis can be used to define clusters, it does not mean these have real identified discontinuities or discrete categories. Figure 20.17. Dendrogram showing sites A, B, and C hierarchically arranged in fewer clusters as the amount of dissimilarity allowed within clusters increases. At 13.3 units of dissimilarity, there are three clusters, A and D, and B and C. These reduce to two clusters, A and D and B, and C, at 57.4 units. Fusion into only one cluster occurs at 68.0 units of maximum dissimilarity within a cluster. In geological applications, cluster analysis has become a commonly used technique to distinguish and help characterize groups on the basis of many types of geological data: major, minor, and isotopic geochemistries, sediment particle sizes, drainage basin morphologies, or fossil contents. Cluster analysis has even been used to group different boulder morphologies and differentiate geochemical units on Mars. In these applications, results of cluster analysis are often highly dependent on normalization of the data for respective variables, particularly because geological data may lack normal or log-normal distributions and be strongly skewed or have multiple modes. 20.18. Which multivariate analysis should you use? The three analyses described in this chapter are all ways of summarizing and simplifying a multivariate data set so that relationships among sampling units can be more easily visualized, but they have different applications. Principal components analysis is useful for data sets where there are few zero values and you need to know which variables contribute most to differences among sampling units. Multidimensional scaling can be used with data sets that contain lots of zero values. Most MDS programs do not give an indication of which original variables contribute to differences among sampling units. Cluster analysis assigns objects to groups based on dissimilarity or similarity, which may help you categorize the sampling units. This chapter has only described three commonly used multivariate methods. This is deliberate. First, many Earth scientists may never use multivariate analyses themselves, but will need a conceptual grasp of how they actually work, so that they can evaluate reports that include summary statistics and conclusions from multivariate data. Second, more powerful methods of analyzing multivariate data are being developed, but most of these are derivations of these three, quote, core methods. 20.19, questions. Discuss the statement, quote, if there are no correlations within a multivariate data set, then principal components analysis really is not very much use at all, unquote. 2. An Earth scientist carried out a principal components analysis and contained the following eigenvalues for components 1 to 5. Which components would you use for a graphical display of the data? Why? 3. What is, quote, stress in the context of two-dimensional summary of the results of a multidimensional scaling analysis? 4. Why are the, quote, groups produced in a cluster analysis often not equivalent to true cases of categorical data, such as black versus white sand grains?